Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, January 2nd. I'm Ray Graff. Hope you had a happy New Year's Day. And what better way to ring in the new decade than with a show favorite? On this first Vox Pop show of 2020, we welcome back astronomer Bob Berman. He is here to answer your puzzling questions about the moon, the sun, and anything else in our solar system. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email your questions to voxpop@wamc.org, but that number is 800-348-2551. Astronomer Bob Berman and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back astronomer Bob Berman to answer your galactic questions. One of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world, Bob is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine, the author of 12 books. If you have a question about the heavens, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back. Happy New Year.
Thank you. The same to you, Ray.
Well, you heard the news, and I guess this you may not have caught this when it happened, but on Sunday night, there was in Saratoga County a bright green flash seen by several and an explosion report of some kind that was heard over five, maybe six towns in Saratoga County, from Broad Auburn south to Charlton to Ballston Spa, and nobody knew what it was at first. We just heard a report. Sheriff Zerlo was on and said that the law enforcement and government, including the FAA, FBI, ATF, National Weather Service, NASA, all chimed in, and they say, okay, yeah, that was a meteor.
Oh, that's so great. And my first reaction is I'm envious. I wish I had seen it, because a meteor that bright, we'd see it for 100 or more miles in all directions.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Nobody saw it. They saw a green flash. There are no reports that I've heard of people actually seeing the meteor.
Well, first of all, was it clear at that time
when
it happened?
I don't know.
Because if it wasn't, then the flash is all you would have seen from a bolide. That's the name for a meteor that does explode and that could produce a flash. What was weird also was the sound, because it's extremely unusual for an exploding meteor to make any kind of sound, because typically they'll explode 60 miles up, which is essentially above the atmosphere. In fact, many agencies define the beginning of space as 62 miles. So it's really marginal in whether there's enough air to carry sound. And the sound, by the way, would take many minutes to reach, so it wouldn't have been simultaneous with the flash. But this would have had been an unusually low penetrating meteor in order to make a sound. So the whole thing's very exciting, and sorry I missed it.
Now, you brought a meteorite in with you several shows ago, and it was not big. It was perhaps the size of a grapefruit, but it weighed, it had to, I don't know, 5 pounds. It was very dense. It was iron.
Yeah.
I understand that if, in fact, what people reported, the explosion in the middle of the night and the green flash, was in fact a bolide, as you say, it didn't have to be very big.
No. In fact, just the one that you reported that I brought into the studio for us to play with that day would have done the trick. And sometimes a larger one will break up into pieces. So this might produce people searching the ground for it. In fact, I would urge the people who live up there, especially if there's snow on the ground, so that you can see a fresh rock more easily, because otherwise it's almost impossible. To show you how impossible, I can tell you that in New York State's entire history, 12 meteorites have been found in the entire state in its entire history. So unlikely, but because it's fresh, if there's a snow cover, that makes it easier.
The NASA being involved and various federal agencies, including the FAA, would there be a radar track on this
thing?
There
could be, yeah, because it leaves behind an ionized trail that could have been seen, especially by military radar. It would be interesting, because if it could be pinpointed exactly where it was, that would make searching for meteoroids that have landed, which then changed their name. It's funny. It keeps changing its name.
Right. Once it hits the ground, it's a night.
That's right. Hits the ground, it's a meteorite. What you see in the sky is a meteor. And before it hits our atmosphere, it's a meteoroid. So, yeah.
And, you know, also in the news, and it's all over the place. This was from CNN, I think. No, Sky and Telescope, December 31st. What's up with Betelgeuse?
Thank you. I appreciate
and,
that.
You know, there's this big deal. It's a variable star, right?
Yes.
And now, all of a sudden, even though this is not all that new, people are saying, well, this thing could go supernova.
It could. And, Ray, it has all the elements for an abstract, esoteric astronomy news event to gain worldwide media attention, because this is one of the few things that, number one, involve a star that's one of the top five most famous, the only one I can think of that had a movie named after it, that one with Gina Davis, and who played the spirit called Betelgeuse? And they called it Betelgeuse.
Oh, our engineer is saying Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton.
Thank you, Zach, the engineer.
And so that certainly gave it a lot of fame. The preferred pronunciation is Betelgeuse, just as you said it.
Right.
But famous star, and those who even know a few constellations at this time of year, every single clear night, features Orion. Most people can find Orion, and there are only two bright stars. It's Foot Star, bluish-white star, Rigel, and its shoulder star, the clearly orange-looking star, Betelgeuse. So because it's so famous, something involving it is easily observed. In fact, I'll tell people how to really check on what's going on. Now, the fact that it's been dimming to the dimmest it's been seen in more than a century is very interesting. But it was way back in the 1830s that the son of William Herschel, John Herschel, first wrote about its variability. And the organization that tracks these, the American Association for Variable Star Observers, has been noting that just since the 1930s, let's say the era of our parents and ourselves, it's varied from magnitude 0.2 to 1.2. Now, that means from about as bright as Rigel in the foot of Orion to about as bright as Aldebaran, the main star of Taurus, which is to the right of Orion. So this gives us a great comparison. So Betelgeuse at its brightest is about Rigel's brightness, and at its dimmest, it's about as bright as Aldebaran, which is also orange and is to the right of Orion. And here's a great thing.
Yeah.
Next Tuesday, the moon is going to be right next to Aldebaran. So if we get a clear night, look up any time during that night, Tuesday night, and right next to the moon, to the right of the moon, will be Aldebaran. And then compare that star to the shoulder star of Orion, which will be to the left of the moon, farther away, to the left of the moon, and see how they compare. Now, normally, Aldebaran, the one that will be next to the moon, is quite a bit dimmer than Betelgeuse. But now, they're the same.
Ah.
So what I'm saying is that we can all keep track of this strange dimming of Betelgeuse and actually see by next week where it stands. Is it continuing to dim? Even if it just matches Aldebaran, it means it's as dim as it gets, really.
Well, how fast will it brighten or dim?
Well, it typically takes weeks or months, and the whole period of brightening to dimming is irregular. But typically, it's a three-year period.
Hmm.
Now, we had in the 1940s a period where it was at its very dimmest one year and at its very brightest the next year. So these could be rapid changes. Now, what does this mean for it blowing up?
Yeah.
Well, it's famous as being the star that's one of the stars nearest to us. It's not very close. It's about 640 light years, although its distance is a little controversial,
Interesting.
Too.
Interesting. Why?
Because it's been measured by different means. We have this Hipparchus satellite, astrometric satellite that measures distance, but it's come up with errors, systematic errors, so that we don't really trust it. And then the Very Large Array has been also measuring it by a different means and came up with a different distance. So it's something like 700 light years away, but it could be 640.
Okay.
And at that distance, the fact that it's so massive, it weighs somewhere between 10 and 20 suns, those are the kind of stars that blow up into a supernova. And Betelgeuse is near the part of its life when stars do that. See, it's a very young star. It's only about 10 million years old. Our sun is 5 billion years old.
Yeah.
So you're talking about 500 times. Our star is 500 times older than
Betelgeuse. How do you know it's only 10 million years old?
Because a star of this mass, as heavy as it is, goes through its fuel so quickly and is giving out so much energy. In fact, in the infrared part of the spectrum, in the heat part of the spectrum, it's the brightest star in the sky.
Hmm.
And so it can't keep giving off its energy and using up its fuel. So these are the stars that are seen to turn into a supernova. But when we say it could happen any time, it could be today or it could be in 100,000 years. And the odds are it'll be more close to 100,000 years than today. Now, here is where we bring in the mass media. We're impatient, we humans. The mass media wants to say, is it going to go supernova? And is the dimming, because it's showing a greater dimming than we've seen for over 100 years, does this mean it's about to go to the supernova? But we've seen it dim this much before, and it didn't blow up then, so why should it blow up now?
Hmm.
It's because we want to say, here's a famous star, Betelgeuse. It's dimmer than it's been in about a century. Maybe this means it's going to blow up. Very few astronomers would ever say, yeah, keep watching and it could blow up. But it could, because we just don't know when it's going to use the last bit of its fuel, no longer be able to support its own giant weight of all those layers, and then collapse into itself, because that's what a supernova involving a single star, that's what happens. And then if it did, wow, would that be fun? It would be the brightest star at night. It would cast shadows. It would be brighter than Venus. We'd still see it in the day.
Wow.
In the day, and it would last for months like that. So,
any danger?
Not at that distance, no. But it could cause a little changing in our atmosphere. It could cause a little bit of extra radiation. So there could be an increase in genetic alterations on Earth.
Fascinating.
Our own evolution of all of our plants and animals could be slightly speeded up by these genetic changes caused by that extra radiation. So,
Of course, that depends on which way it's pointing, right?
No, not in this case, because it's giving off the energy. A supernova radiates in all directions, so we're going to get our share.
Ah, okay. But not a direct hit of a concentrated.
Right. It's not aimed our way. It's not beamed our way by magnetic fields or anything. And it's so far. That's the big thing
okay.
that dilutes the impact.
Bob Berman is our guest. We'll take a quick break and then we'll jump on the phones. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Bob, we got a few emails here, but Raphael in Kingston has been waiting a while. Raphael, you go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the magnetic fields of some of the planets in our solar system.
Sure.
Why do some have a magnetic field and why others do not?
Yeah, well, it's theoretical because, for example, Mars does not have a global magnetic field. We do. Mercury has almost none. Jupiter's is amazingly powerful, which holds and traps radiation. So it varies from planet to planet, as you're saying. And we think that there's two main reasons. One is if there's a liquid core of metal, like what Earth has, and then the planet spinning around that acts as a dynamo and generates the electric field. So you get something like Mars, which is only half our size. Even though it spins at the same rate that we do, its day is only 24 hours, 37 minutes, and 23 seconds.
Yeah.
That's half an hour longer than ours. So it's got the spin, but the small size means it probably lost its heat, enough heat so that it doesn't have the metal core, And that probably explains why it doesn't have it. Jupiter, with that huge mass, 317 times heavier than Earth, has so much heat in the center. The heat probably rivals the surface of the sun. And hydrogen, which is what it's mostly made of, acts as a metal in those pressures. So that allows for it to have that huge magnetic field. In the case of Mercury, it only spins in 59 days. In the case of Venus, it only spins in 224.7 days, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And that's so slow that that's not going to have the energy to generate a field. So what I'm saying is that from planet to planet, the situation either encourages it or discourages a magnetic field.
Raphael, thanks for the call. This email came in from Mike in Rexford. Over the past few nights, there have been reports of Neptune shining brightly near the moon. To my recollection, Neptune has always been fairly dim. Has something changed? And that's from Mike in Rexford.
Yeah, I don't know why anyone would say that. They are near each other in the sky, but of course the moon is 2 seconds away at the speed of light, and Neptune is, 3.5 hours away at the speed of light. And Neptune, you're right, it's eighth magnitude. You can't even see it through binoculars. You'd need a backyard telescope to see it at all. So I don't know who's saying it's shining more brightly.
So to your knowledge, it is not?
No.
Okay. This one is from Vicky. And Vicky writes, what do you see new for the new year in astronomy?
Oh, we've got a great year. I mean, in addition to discoveries by the armada of spacecraft we have and the world's observatories, which are larger and more sophisticated than ever.
Yeah.
Just in terms of what we can expect in the sky, I think it's going to be one of the best years of our lives because the moon is going to not interfere with the great meteor showers. We're having one these nights, but it's cloudy, unfortunately.
Well, it is around here.
Right. That giant meteor seen the other night could have been one of the Quadrantids, which is the shower that's going on now. But the two most famous and best showers, two stand way above all the others on most years, the Perseids on August 11th and the Geminids on December 13th, and they both are going to be left alone by the moon. So this is a great year for that. We're going to have Venus, the evening star. It's already the brightest star that you'd see right after sunset low in the west, but it's going to be unusually high and bright and throughout spring.
Okay.
We're going to have a great opposition of Mars in the fall, and I've saved the best for last.
Yeah.
There's one standout event this year that's going to make this year really, really memorable.
Solar eclipse?
Oh, I wish. I mean,
no,
there will be one. I'm going to Patagonia on December 14th to take people to see a solar eclipse, but none here.
When's the next one in North America?
On April 8th, 2024.
Ah, 24. Okay.
But what's going to happen is on the winter solstice, exactly, we're going to have the finest planet conjunction of our lives. We're going to have Jupiter and Saturn meet. Now, they meet every 20 years. In fact, classically, the ancients always called it the Great Conjunction because it's rare and it's bright. But this time, the two are going to come so close together that the two planets are going to merge into a single bright star in the sky, at least for those whose eyesight's not very good. I mean, if you have sharp eyes, you'll see them as two very close together stars. But anyone with a backyard telescope will see these two planets in the same high power field. So imagine seeing Saturn with the rings and Jupiter with its bands and its moons together in the same telescope field. So I think I'm going to have a little thing happening at our observatory and invite some people over. I don't know how we'll limit it, but
that's cool.
Boy, that's an amazing event on the winter solstice of 2020.
What the ancients must have thought of that.
Oh, they would have flipped.
This is the last email, and then we'll get back to the phones. 800-348-2551. This is from Michael in Key West. Could Bob talk about the connection between consciousness, matter, and creation of the universe? All right, you have 30 seconds.
That's funny. Consciousness, matter, and the creation of the universe.
Right.
Well, as he probably knows, just bringing up the question, there's increasing feeling among even scientists that the universe may be consciousness-based rather than matter-based. Now, I know we teach around the world that the universe started with a Big Bang, and that was matter-based. In other words, a thing popped out of nothingness. We don't know how it would have happened, expanded, and that started it going. And that consciousness arose from life, which started on Earth and maybe many other places as well. We don't know. But the other view that started with the quantum geniuses of the early part of the 20th century. We're talking about Werner Heisenberg and Max Planck and all of these guys who noticed that in the realm of the tiny with electrons and photons of light, that the observer, consciousness, determined by whether how you looked at it and whether you looked at it determined where these small particles were, whether or not they had this property rather than that property. And they realized, they didn't want to realize this, but they started realizing that consciousness or the observer, conscious observer, determines the fundamentals of what we see around us. That when nobody's looking, an electron could be anywhere. In fact, is in all its possible positions at once. But when somebody looks, we do it, we see this in a lab, one of those locations becomes real. All of the other locations, possibilities vanish. And this stunned everybody. And it's all led to Bob Lanza, Dr. Lanza's idea of biocentrism, which, hey, everything's pointing to life being central to the universe, not dumb, random matter being central to the universe. So if you take this biocentric idea, and this is how I know I'm long-winded answer to the question, it means that what's basic in the universe is mind or consciousness, and that's what always exists, and that everything else stems from that rather than it being a dumb matter-based universe. So
all right,
there it is.
And yet Betelgeuse is going to explode into a supernova.
Yeah, eventually, yes.
Showering us, at least in small part, with some radiation.
Yes.
A physical thing, right?
Yeah, that's a physical thing. But the question is whether that would happen if nobody was observing it and what that would mean. That's another issue that we can't even bring up now because
that'll be the whole show.
Well, also, it sounds so outrageous and absurd that unless you introduce it properly, it just sounds idiotic, actually.
Well, I wouldn't say that. Let's go back to the phones and forget all about it. George in Northern New Jersey. George, you're on.
Ray, hi, and Bob, thank you.
Hi.
You just answered most of my question.
Oh.
I embarked on a project which will hopefully be an animated film, and it had to do with the beginning, the Big Bang, you know, as a start. And religiously, I was raised in the Catholic system, it's and the Word, right? And the Word created, correct?
Hmm. You still there, George?
I'm here.
Okay. So what's your question for Bob?
Or for you, when
well,
we're talking about the Catholic race.
I was originally going to ask, how do you describe pre-Big Bang? Are there words to describe it?
That's the question that Bob can never answer.
Well, because you're talking about nothingness. You know, I mean, science, everything points to a Big Bang because you could just trace back the motion of all galaxy clusters, and they were all in one place at one time, 13.8 billion years ago. So obviously they began expanding at that point, so we call that expansion a Big Bang. Now, what happened before that? Well, there couldn't really have been time before there was any changes. If there was true nothingness, you get into the philosophical issue of what is nothingness, and does the word is contradict nothing, so that you're speaking nonsense. You're not even making sense to yourself. But beyond that, if nothing changes, if there's no matter or energy, then in what sense could there be time? In what sense is there anything? And the big question, how could a Big Bang start? How do you get the whole universe from nothingness? I mean, is there really a free lunch here? And of course, not only does nobody know the answer, but you can't even begin to imagine it. Yes, theories say that there were membranes of another dimension, and the brains, B-R-A-N-E-S, collided, and in the colliding of the brains, this produced the Big Bang. But it's still not an answer because it really doesn't explain it.
But there are. Let me just add one thing, and I'll leave you. Some people in conversation throughout the past couple of years or whenever say, well, these elements are the things that exploded. I'm using that generically.
Well, if there are elements, like, that means there's
like
some...
Carbon, hydrogen, et cetera, were the things that organized and became the explosion for the Big Bang.
No, you in the Big Bang, one thing our physics shows us is that the density and the temperature of the Big Bang would not have allowed there to be solid objects like carbon that you're describing, or even in a gaseous form. So you're talking about a situation that would not have even allowed subatomic particles. This was pre-electron. In fact, you didn't have the first electrons. You didn't have sometime after that, and you didn't have the first clear universe, transparent universe, until about 800,000 years after the Big Bang. Before then, you couldn't have even had light traveling across the universe. And that's why, by the way, the one relic from it that we do see, which is the cosmic microwave background, this radiation that's in the microwave part of the spectrum, because it's the waves have shifted from their original gamma ray nature, that didn't even happen until 800,000 years later, because you needed a clear or transparent universe in order for light to propagate. Before that, any photon of light would have hit another atom and been absorbed. And so, in other words, the universe was a fog and you couldn't have seen anything. So our science is good enough to trace back what must have been here at this point, what must have been there at that point. But when you get back to the Big Bang itself, it's a blank wall.
All right, George, thank you very much for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Len in Greenfield. Len, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. My question for Bob is, why is everything in our galaxy spinning in the same direction?
Well, we think, and it is, you're right. In our solar system, everything is counterclockwise. If you're north of the solar system, all the planets go around the sun, and the sun itself rotates, and all of the moons of all the planets go in that same direction, except for one big exception, which is the main moon of Neptune, Triton. And in the galaxy itself, on a larger scale, the spinning is all in one direction. And that just means that if we started out from a big cloud of gas, hydrogen gas, from which all the stars in the galaxy eventually condensed, and there's still a lot of hydrogen left over, by the way, for new stars to be formed, there was a little bit of motion to it, because there's motion everywhere. To have no motion would be astonishing, because any movement or collisions are going to impart motion to things. So you have, and as things contract, the preservation of angular momentum increases the spin. So you have every galaxy that we've ever seen rotating, and you can even tell which way they're rotating, because you know how spiral galaxies have arms? Always picture them rotating so that they would wind the arms tighter.
Mm.
And if you picture that, you even can tell which way they're spinning. And they all do it.
Huh. Well, that's fascinating. Thank you very much for that. I always thought that maybe it had something to do with the particles of energy that comprise the planets and the bodies themselves spinning in a certain direction. I don't know if that's true of atoms as well.
Yeah, but then how do you impart that to the huge scale that we're talking about of an object 100,000 light years across, like our galaxy?
Right. Well, thank you so much for that. I've always wondered.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Len. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Bob Berman is our guest. Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. Andrea in Westfield. Andrea.
Hello. Thank you for talking with me. I appreciate it.
Sure.
I heard the gentleman refer to the solstice. I thought the solstice was December 21st, 2019. Was he referring to the solstice in 2020?
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. The solstice of 2020.
Oh, okay.
And that's when we're going to have the best planet conjunction of our lives, for people who tuned in late. In our whole lives, we will have never seen two planets coming together that closely.
Hmm.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. I remember we were up at the beach a couple of summers ago, and I think five planets in a basically straight line.
Yeah, like a string of pearls.
And it just caught your attention, and it was one of those things you just don't forget.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Astronomy Today on the program. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC Astronomy Today with Bob Berman. The number is 800-348-2551. I had a question. Your name popped up on New Year's Eve. We had some folks over, and one of the people said, I never forget it. We were in Albany over by Whitehall Road years ago, and my son and I were just talking about this. We saw the aurora, and it was really, really bright. And I was thinking, with all the city lights in Albany, that must have been very bright. How often does it happen that you can see the auroras in a city situation? Now, I've seen them in the suburbs in the dead of night with no streetlights, and right, they're beautiful. But when you're in a city, there are lights everywhere.
There are lights everywhere. You're right. I'm so pessimistic about answering that in any kind of way that gives hope to anyone in a city. But you're right. We get a good aurora here about once a decade. That will be sometimes in completely across the sky. We had one on 1989 on March 13th of that year that was all night long and all sky. So we do get them from up here. But from most of it is, honestly speaking, only about as bright as the Milky Way. So if you're in a city where the lights are so bright that you don't see the Milky Way, you are not likely to see the auroras even when they're better.
But sometimes you can, very rarely.
Very rarely.
Yeah. All right. And, of course, this is probably your big time of year where Bob gets in the big mystery bus and goes up north.
It's true. We take a group of people every single March. We've been doing it for a quarter century to our secret places.
You don't really take a mystery bus, though, right?
No. We have our own bus because we do – a little bit of it is by bus because we do some special thing. This is Central Alaska, not where the tourists go, but special – we even take them – dog sledding out to places and hot springs, and the auroras are there. It's almost every night, and it's just incredible, bright enough. And I have my little 5-number checklist as to how good this aurora is compared to the way they can be. One of them is it lighting up the ground so that all the mountains that you can see going into the distance are green instead of white?
Oh.
Another is there rapid motion, or is it just slowly changing?
Which I like too.
Yeah, it's
and you, you would go so the you would go for the rapid motion being better. Is that more energetic?
It's more unusual. It's more unusual.
Is there more energy involved? In other words, to get that motion, the shimmering, whatever you would call it.
That's right. I mean, there's something nice about the more normal, slowly changing patterns, too. But, yeah, the rapid flickering. And sometimes they look like curtains.
Oh, I've seen that.
And those are really special. But they're curtains. If they're high overhead or directly overhead, it makes you look like you're under a curtain and seeing the perspective, because the folds of the curtains head away from you and converge at some spot in outer space. So they're not just straight lines. They converge.
It's pretty cool, though. Yep.
Yeah.
Bob Berman is our guest. How do people I assume you're going to go up there this winter.
Yep.
How do people find out about it?
It would be specialinteresttours.com. There'll be the dates and the price. It's pretty cheap.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Travis in Middletown. Travis.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I got a question. I watched something recently on, it was called Boots Void. It was a massive bit of space where there's just no stars whatsoever. I was hoping that you could explain how something like that could occur, or like how there's stars everywhere, but just that area, there doesn't seem to be any stars.
Yeah, that's in the constellation of, I like that you said Boots. It's Bootes, is often pronounced, but who would know how to spell B-O-O-T-E-S? It's the herdsman, where the brightest star in that constellation is the famous Arcturus. But that's a region that, and you're right, stars are generally randomly scattered, but there's more concentrations along the spiral arms. For example, if you do look towards Betelgeuse, which is in the news these days, and see all how bright Orion is and how many stars there are, and then move your head 90 degrees in the sky and look to the right of you, to the left of you, you'll see emptiness, just like the kind you're describing. And that shows you that into the spiral arms, you get a lot of stars. Between the spiral arms and away from the plane of our galaxy, you see very few stars. So there are regions like this. And the ones in space where the galaxies, which are also scattered, they also tend to form groups. But then there are some areas where you have giant voids. In fact, there's a great void in the direction of Centaurus that's very empty. And another one that's has so many galaxies that it's actually pulling on us. And it changes the expansion of the universe so that we're pulled weirdly by it. So you do have these anomalies of matter. So you've brought up a very fascinating point.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Now, in these vast spaces of emptiness between the galaxies, you had talked about the energy of atoms and how it's very tough to get things to be completely stopped. Is there any spot where there's absolute zero out there, or is there always an ambient temperature?
That was the big one. Fascinating. When I studied this stuff in school, we thought that far from any star and especially galaxy, you'd reach absolute zero.
Yeah.
The temperature at which there's no atomic motion. That's in the Fahrenheit scale, it's 459.67 degrees, and that's as cold as you can get.
Below zero.
But now all the studies have been done. Now that we had the COBE satellite, it all started with the actual detection of it, which was Nobel Prize winning in the 60s, that actually showed that there's leftover toastiness heat from the Big Bang that permeates all of space, and it's only 2.73 degrees Celsius. This is above absolute zero.
Kelvin
or is it Kelvin?
Yeah.
Yep. Degrees Kelvin above absolute degrees Celsius above absolute zero is called Kelvin. You're quite right. So it's roughly 5 degrees Fahrenheit. And that this heat, because it's still left over from the Big Bang, permeates everything. So that's as cold as you could get, even if you got far away from every star and galaxy.
And you had also mentioned that there is this fizzing of quantum matter that sort of pops in and out of existence. Yeah. Have we ever detected any sort of temperature to do with that?
No, it's never been observed, but it's still theorized, and it must be real because it must explain why there is still some energy associated with nothingness, because we believe that absent anything, you'll still have like a snap, crackle, pop of energy, and this quantum energy is always there. So it's sort of a background.
The number to call here on Vox Pop is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Layla in Mount Tremper, you're on.
Hi, folks. Thank you very much.
Hi.
I'm wondering if there is an easy way to hop online if one of these celestial events happens and it's cloudy here. Is there a place to observe it from, if you know?
Well, yes, and it depends on the celestial event. For example, if you can't get to a total solar eclipse, or like that recent annular eclipse that we had on December 26th, then there is an observatories that have been set up around the world that are available for free for the public to witness the event. And I know because I sometimes narrate these events online, and that's on SLOO, S-L-O-O-H. So if you go to SLOO, you'll see which celestial events, even if it's cloudy here, or even if it's an event that cannot be seen from here, you'll still be able to see it on SLOO.com. That's the main computer-based resource for that kind of thing.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sure thing.
Thanks for the call. Over to Vic in West Springfield. Vic, you're on.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I had heard that when you're observing the aurora, you can actually hear it if you're in the right place at the right time at the right intensity.
Well, that's
a controversy.
That's controversial. When I first heard about that, my first thought is, oh, that's impossible. But we had in Woodstock, near where I live, there's a fellow prominent person in town who goes hunting into Canada, into remote parts of Canada every year. And he told me he's heard them clearly, like hisses,
yeah,
during bright displays. And during these 25 years now that we've been running these aurora tours up in Alaska, I've heard direct reports from people who say, yeah, sometimes when they're very bright, we hear definite noises associated with them. And these people are obviously not lying. And so I believe that people can hear them. I never have in this quarter century of seeing this one aurora
now
year.
They're way up. What causes that?
And you're right, Ray. In theory, they'd be impossible because aurora typically happens 100 miles up. There's not enough air there to carry sound. And if it did, think of how long it would take for that sound to get from 100 miles up. If there was like a sudden movement or a flash of an aurora, it would take many minutes before you'd hear an effect.
So this is magnetic of some kind affecting your brain directly?
Exactly. So the only mechanism we can think of is that perhaps the electromagnetic effects of the aurora, and that travels at the speed of light. So in other words, every time there is an atomic change, and that's an electromagnetic effect, We know that because radio waves also travel at the speed of light. Maybe some people, through the fillings in their teeth or who knows what mechanism,
yeah,
can receive it, and then they perceive it as a hissing,
yeah,
in their consciousness. So I don't doubt it because I've heard too many reports of it.
You know, you and I have talked about this in years past. In the 70s, my father, my brother, and I were sitting out on the back deck a nice summer night. Huge bolide went over. It was seen from, I don't know, south of New York up to Maine. And it fizzed, man. We all heard it.
At the same time you saw it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, no doubt about it.
So to see it at the same time you heard it, there too. A bolide definitely causes ionization of the air, and you heard it.
Oh, we all did.
Well, there it is.
And it was loud. It wasn't like it was a, oh, what was that? It was a good loud fizz, like you pop an Alka-Seltzer in a glass.
I love it. Okay. Yeah. So for mechanisms that nobody knows yet, humans can perceive these things.
Our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Robert in Turner's Falls. Robert.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I have a question. If there really were a Big Bang billions of years ago, wouldn't that be followed by some kind of sonic, traveling at the speed of sound shockwave, just a destructive planet-crushing shockwave?
Well, yes, there'd be a shockwave, but remember, there has to be a medium to carry either sound or any kind of shockwave, and space is empty. But on the other hand, you'll probably quickly say, but the Big Bang immediately was dense because we had a whole universe worth of matter and energy compressed into that small space. So shouldn't that have been enough to allow the propagation of shockwaves? And you're right, because we have a process now called baryon acoustic oscillations that is now a modern way of gaining information about the early universe and even about our current universe by observing these shockwaves that propagated through space earlier on when everything was more dense. We call it baryon acoustic oscillations. So that's a very method going according to what you have just said on the radio.
Wow, very cool. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And is there you talk about the cosmic microwave background. Is there a gravitational wave background?
Well, that's a good question, because gravity also propagates at the speed of light. So if we have a 2.73 degree Kelvin temperature from the Big Bang, shouldn't there be gravitational effects? Now, everything started out smooth, and once you have smoothness, you don't have anything to really detect. Something that's universal doesn't attract the senses in any way. So, but any place in the universe where you have just by random chance, you have greater amounts of matter, and they should form, let's say, galaxies or massive stars, and these collide. Now you have a change in gravity, and this was actually detected. The gravity from one of those was detected by that great LIDO detector in the Atacama Desert just, what was it, a year or two ago?
Yeah.
So the answer is yes again.
Very interesting. Bob Berman is our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. Let's see. Well, we have a call here on line one, and let's go right over to Marie. We can't get to Marie. All right. Oh, here we go. Hi, who's this?
Hello, Scott Patterson. How are you?
Hi, Scott. You're on. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm on already. Yeah. Okay. I am curious about whether or not if any elements, heavy elements made beyond iron. At first they thought it was after a supernova, and now they're saying that it's a collision of two neutron stars. Does this both exist, or is it strictly neutron stars that make elements heavier than collision of neutron stars that are heavier that make elements heavier than iron? And the other question I had was in how do we figure out what generation star our star would be from the time of the Big Bang? Can we figure that out based on the elements that are currently burning in it? Can we figure out the size of the previous stars and possibly what generation star we have?
Let me take that last question first. Which generation is our sun? And for people who are wondering, what are we talking about? Well, you started with the Big Bang with plain vanilla hydrogen and helium.
Yeah.
That's all there was from the Big Bang. A little bit of lithium thrown in just to, you know, take care of any depression that any of these
early galaxies had.
So, and then from there, you had stars that formed from extra bits of mass of this hydrogen and helium. But some of these stars were so massive that they go through their lifetime faster than normal. That's what Betelgeuse is doing. And then blow up into a supernova. But that supernova then throws out not only bits of itself, but things that were created inside stars. And that's why when the caller says iron, you're quite right. Stars, every star fuses hydrogen to helium, helium into iron and carbon, and on up it goes until you reach iron. Iron can't fuse into anything else because you lose energy. You don't gain energy from it. So iron is the end of the line, and stars don't make anything heavier than iron. But when a star explodes in a supernova, all that material, including the iron in its core, gets spread out. And now, if that material encounters a fresh cloud of hydrogen that's just minding its own business somewhere and gives it an extra push of extra density, so that now that starts collapsing to form new stars, we say that's the second generation of stars. And these stars are enriched with the stuff given off by the first generation. So these start off with metals that the original stars didn't have. If some of these go through their lifetime and explode and throw off material, then you can get a third generation of stars that are even more enriched and have more metals. Well, our sun is a third generation star.
Ah.
And we know that because just using a handheld spectroscope, which everybody should own, and you look at the star, you'll see the spectral lines of calcium and magnesium and manganese and things that you wouldn't get if our star were a first-generation star. So right there on that sun's bright surface, its photosphere, we see the gaseous lines of metals proving that it's a third-generation star.
Now, can you have a fourth or fifth-generation star?
I don't know that. I've not heard of that. So I'd have to do the rare but humble. I don't know.
All right, Bob Berman. Well, we're about out of time. Once again, if people want to find out more about your tours, how do they do that?
Specialinteresttours.com. Can I tell him about elements heavier than iron?
You have about 10 seconds to do that.
Okay, because I did say that first part of the question. We think you only get those from exploding supernovae, because there you're going to have the fantastic temperatures that can even sock iron together and produce heavier things still, such as uranium.
All right. So we'll find out when Betelgeuse goes.
That's right.
In 100,000 years or tomorrow.
Right.
Bob Berman, thank you for being here. Support comes from Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts, locally owned and operated for over 50 years. With indoor and outdoor plants, gardening supplies, bird feeders and seeds, organic fertilizer and advice, HadleyGardenCenter.com. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond, skidmore.edu/tang. And Personal Wine Cellar, Glenville, home of Cellar Dweller, an eclectic selection of red, white wines and spirits, wine tasting every Thursday and Friday, home delivery services Thursday through Sunday, 518-399-9463. Thanks again to Bob Berman for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Jim Harrison. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, the folks from Stack's Espresso Bar and Harney & Sons Fine Teas join us. We'll get all caffeinated. It'll be a fine program, in theory. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.